So this particular practice has been described in some of the old Zen literature in kind of militaristic ways. A lot of it came from the spirit of Japan. Zen gets interpreted via the various cultures through which it shines through. And there's a statement made by a Zen master that I think is very useful. It does have kind of a battle connotation. But this particular Zen master said, and this was in the context of one coming to awakening, breaking through into a clear perception of the true nature of reality. And he put it this way. He said, if you want to know your enemy is conceptual thinking. Your enemy, the thing blocking you, the thing opposing your entering into this clarity of direct seeing. So if you want to know your enemy is conceptual thinking. Now, he didn't say thinking. This is important. Your enemy is not thinking. Because if your enemy was thinking, then to come to awakening, you would have to do Zazen in a way where you would suppress all thinking. There would never be the arising of a thought. And you'd be constantly checking to see if thoughts were arising, and that would be a thought. So it would be an endless process. Sometimes they're described as trying to wash blood off with blood. The more you try to wash, the bloodier you get. So it's not so much getting rid of this secretion of the brain, which is one way we can think of thinking, as a secretion or a function of the brain. An extremely important function. One that keeps us alive and that has enabled us to succeed in the battle of evolution, and without which we probably all, somewhere between here and home after this is over, would come to cropper, as they put it. So thinking is not the enemy in this way that the Zen master put it. He said conceptual thinking. Now, what does he mean by conceptual thinking? And we'll read something from another master in a minute about this, but what is conceptual thinking? So if thinking is this secretion of the brain, it's the normal waking brain, and even the sleeping brain is continually elaborating thoughts, and we know what these are. It would be hard to describe it to someone who never had a thought. Just like it'd be hard to describe a color to someone that was blind from birth. Think about it. How would you describe red to someone who's blind from birth? How would you describe a thought to something that never had a thought? How would you describe it to a rock, for example? But you know what it is. Because you sense it. You feel it. It has a form. Thinking has a form to it. And the brain is the sensory organ of thoughts. Just like the eye is the sensory organ of colors. So what is conceptual thinking? Not thinking, which is a normal output of our brains. Well, if you look at the root of the word concept, and I may be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure I'm right from the Latin, and just to let you know as a disclaimer, I got a D in Latin in high school. I just thought it was so pointless, and later it became extremely important when I went to medical school. Stupid me. But conceptual, all right, so the two pieces of the word con and sept. So con in Latin means with, and sept means to grasp. So a concept is something you grasp with. You grasp something with it. This is just so wonderful. I love it when words work out this way. So conceptual thinking is something you use to grasp something else with. Now, to give you a kind of a colorful image of what this means, And I'll go way back to my first year of medical school when I did something that they call gross anatomy. And it is gross, but you basically dissect a cadaver. It's a preserved cadaver. It's quite preserved with formaldehyde and emanates the smell of formaldehyde during the entire process, which takes several weeks and many, many, many hours. But I had a gross anatomy instructor who recommended, he said, look, it's up to you. You know, you can not do what I recommend, but this is traditional. Not everybody does it. I understand if you don't want to. But if you really want to get to know the body, the feel of the interior of the body, the feel of these tissues, you should conduct your anatomy, your dissection, without gloves. And I did that. Big mistake, probably, because I absorbed a lot of formaldehyde. And when I went to eat lunch, the smell emanated from my hands, but I got very used to that very quickly. But you could feel the tissue, like when you were dissecting tissues, you could feel nerve in the middle of fat, for example. So you would be able to dissect that out because you had a very acute sense of it directly through your fingers. So this is direct touching in a dissection. And gloves would be, you would be grasping with gloves. It'd be a kind of like conceptual thinking. So this direct grasping of an experience, and this putting on the gloves of thinking to grasp the experience, which is to name it, to compare it, to put it in a hierarchy of importance, to see how well it matches another thinking template that you have of how it ought to be, to predict the future, and then try to do this and that to make that predicted future more likely to happen, although it never arrives, because the future is the cloud of probability, and anything that arrives is collapsed, and it's just this moment. So, in a sense, thinking are the gloves. And gloves are very, very useful. There are times when gloves are really important, and I probably should have worn them. But if you want to feel something directly, you have to take off the gloves. Now, that doesn't mean you have to go through the whole lab and destroy all the gloves in the lab, like take them and tear them apart and then burn them in an incinerator. You just don't put them on. They're there, but you are directly contacting without the intervening layer of gloves. So if I breathe through my nose and I smell the incense, that's just direct. A glove would be, I remember that incense from a session 3 years ago. Let's see, that's some kind of sandalwood. I think they got it in Japan. You see what I mean? This is how we get off and running. Now that's a very benign example. But there are quite malignant examples of conceptual thinking, including all the thoughts that we have about how we fail, how we're not good enough, how to get enlightened we're going to have to get rid of this and that feeling and this and that reaction and this and that habit pattern and all the rest of it, and all the ideas we have about what it's like to be a perfect human being and how I fall short of being a perfect human being. So you can see how malignant this conceptual thinking can get. So, I personally feel that one of the most critical and essential aspects of Sazen is learning how to take off the gloves of conceptual thinking. That really is an essential aspect of Sazen. And when you do that, you are on the road to awakening. And until you do that, you're spinning your wheels. And you can spin your wheels for a long, long time, for years and years and years. I can tell you that personally. As long as you cling to subtle concepts and you use your Zazen because you have these concepts of how you ought to be and how you're not matching that template in your mind, you use your Zazen as a self-improvement project. And like any self-improvement project, you never reach the end of it. You ever try to fix an old house? It's kind of like that. So let's read something from a wonderful, wonderful Tang Dynasty Zen master. This is Wang Po. Wang Po was the teacher of Rinzai, and Lin Chi would be his Chinese name, Wang Po's Chinese name. So Lin Chi was translated into Japan as Rinzai. And he was the founder of one of several schools of Zen that has now survived. There's only two schools of Zen out of seven or eight schools originally that evolved over a period of time through the Tang Dynasty. There's only two schools left. One is the Rinzai school, which is the vigorous, it's the school that Zen has its kind of reputation in the West from, this vigorous, intense, smash through the gates of heaven type Zen, using koan and deep questioning and back and forth between the student and teacher and striking with a stick and shouting and all these things, which can be very, very wonderful. And then the other school is Soto, which is much more contemplative, internal, silent, subtle. And this particular school that I resonate with is the one that I was trained through, which is an amalgam of the two. And I also spent some time with a Rinzai master and lived for a year in a Rinzai monastery. So that was early in my experience, and it really colored my Zen practice for many, many years. And I find that in my old age, I'm resonating more and more with the more subtle kind of Soto approach, which is how my teaching seems to have evolved. But they're both very important, and I think that we need to really have a foundation in both of these approaches and bring them together. So I'm going to read this from Wang Po. He was actually pre-Rinzai school of Zen, because Rinzai was his student, and he's the one through whose very fiery personality and intensity and brilliance this school of Rinzai Zen emanated from. But it started, at least in the period just before Rinzai, with Wang Po. So I want to read something from this book. It's called The Zen Teaching of Wang Po. And this is section 17 in something called the Chun Chao Record. So he says here, ordinary people all indulge in conceptual thought based on environmental phenomena. Hence, they feel desire and hatred. Here it is, it says it all. This is the enemy. So ordinary people, and that includes all of us here in this room, and I'm sure Wang Po at the times when he's not feeling sharp, all indulge in conceptual thought based on environmental phenomena. In other words, the conceptual thought relates to environmental phenomena, to forms that appear in our awareness, through our senses. And conceptual thought then brings about what he called desire and hatred, or grasping and rejection. Grasping onto that which my conceptual thought identifies in this world of ever-changing forms as something desirable and something I don't want to go away, even though I know deep inside it's temporary, because everything's temporary. Or hatred, meaning that although it is already here inevitably, I hate it and I'm going to get rid of it. And this is called the human condition. Now, Dogen, the wonderful Soto Zen master, had a beautiful saying that I love to remind myself of. And he put it this way. He said, though we hate them, weeds grow. Though we love them, flowers fall. Kind of coming from the other side of it, okay? So the ordinary person in Wang Po's description here sees a weed and generates conceptual thought, oh my God, that weed killer didn't work, damn it, paying this gardener and he's not doing his job and all these dandelions are growing. And Dogen says, though we hate them, weeds grow. Some kind of recognition. He took off the gloves It's just a direct recognition. He recognizes the conceptual thought, though I hate it. But because he's not holding the thought, it's like the glove that's there on the table, but he's not feeling the weed through the glove. Though I hate them, weeds grow. He's entering some direct connection with something bigger. Sure, I hate weeds, but they grow. I love flowers, but flowers fall. So I'll go on here. So Wang Po goes on and he says, to eliminate environmental phenomena, just put an end to your conceptual thinking. When this ceases, environmental phenomena are void. Okay, so this is interesting and very, very subtle. Very subtle. To eliminate environmental phenomena, just put an end to your conceptual thinking. When this ceases, environmental phenomena are void. And when these are void, thought ceases. Okay. So let me just go into this a little bit. So he's talking about environmental phenomena. Now, this too is a concept, environmental phenomena. Okay, think about it. Phenomena, meaning form, sure. It's the generalization of, and seeing a color, okay, I call it phenomena. And then environmental, out there, existing, outside me, standing outside, environmental phenomena. All of this depends upon conceptual thinking too. The idea that I'm here and it's there. It has some existence apart from me. When I turn away, it's still there. Even though quantum physics says that's not true. It's been proven. So he says, to eliminate environmental phenomena, in other words, to get past the stuckness of this notion that there's an external world out there that you have to contend with and entangle with, as I sometimes put it. To eliminate environmental phenomena, just put an end to your conceptual thinking. When this ceases, environmental phenomena are void. Okay? They're void. They're empty. They're just appearing. Their appearance. They're no longer something solid, fixed, external. They become ever-changing, evanescent appearances in awareness. And when these are void, then all the ideas about what they mean and whether you like them or not and how important they are and how I want to hold on to it, feel like trying to hold on to a dream. When you finally see it as a dream, all your grasping at the events in the dream suddenly cease. You see through the dream. It's not outside you. Remember, I've defined dreams in the past. I said that the essence of a dream is that not one iota is outside the mind of the dreamer. Think about that. The essence of a dream is that not one iota, not one atom of this extremely real thing called a dream is outside the mind of the dreamer. And the dream continues as long as the dreamer thinks it's outside. How amazing, isn't it? The minute the dreamer recognizes that not one iota of this thing is outside the dreamer, it becomes obvious that it's just a dream and the dream ends. But if you try to eliminate environment without first putting a stop to conceptual thought, you will not succeed, but merely increase its power to disturb you. So if you try to make this world go away and enter some samadhi by pushing away all these thoughts and feelings and emotions and sounds and things going on in the room and things going on in your life, you will not succeed, but merely increase its power to disturb you. Thus, all things are not, so he says, all things are not, N-A-U-G-H-T, all things are not, but mind, and this is capital M, but mind. In other words, the one mind, not a personal mind that has contents, but the one mind, the mind side of reality, this so-called flip side, side that has no color, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, intangible mind. So what can you hope to attain? Those who are students of Prajna hold that there is nothing tangible whatsoever. So they cease thinking of the three vehicles. Okay, the three vehicles are, I was going to say Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but it's the three great schools actually teaching gradual enlightenment. So three, there were schools teaching gradual enlightenment. They were more from India, and this Chan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism broke out of that notion that there was a gradual process through these three vehicles. So he said, those who are students of Prajna, which means wisdom, seeing through to the truth, hold that there's nothing tangible whatsoever. So that there's nothing out there. There's no stuffness to it. It is empty like a dream. So what can you hope to attain? Grasp. Those who are students of Prajna hold that there is nothing tangible whatever. So they cease thinking of the three vehicles. There is only the one reality, neither to be realized nor attained. This is a very critical point. This is something that with awakening becomes obvious. But no amount of words can adequately describe the meaning of this sentence. There is only the one reality, neither to be realized nor attained. To say, I am able to realize something, or I am able to attain something, is to place yourself among the arrogant. And once again, this is conceptual thinking. It's using thinking to grasp the world. The men who flapped their garments and left the meeting, as mentioned in the Lotus Sutra, flapping their garments and walking out on the Buddha, were just such people. Therefore, the Buddha said, I truly obtain nothing from enlightenment. There is just a mysterious, tacit understanding and no more. These are very profound, profound and subtle words. But I think it's important, on the one hand, to really stretch and really not know. As they say in Zen, not knowing is most intimate. To hear words like this and just be thrown into a profound doubt. But at the same time, to be very clear about the process, the tools. So this conceptual thinking, remember now, this is what the glove that I put on in order to feel the world. And no matter how accurate the concepts, meaning no matter how thin the glove, what I'm feeling is the inside of the glove. It could be exceedingly thin. I'm still feeling the inside of the glove. The concept can be exceedingly subtle, exceedingly accurate, but I'm experiencing the concept, not the reality. So in Zen and in our Zazen, we have to go very directly to the thing itself. The first thing we do is we identify that thoughts are present. They are sensations. They are secreted by the brain, and they don't stop just because we want them to stop and we do battle with them. But we don't need to do battle with them. We just need to not put them on or take them off. In other words, observe the thought as like anything else, a phenomenon like the smell of incense, the sound of a car, the color red. What happens then? We sense the thought as this finished product in the present moment, but the meaning of it becomes irrelevant. We just notice that we're thinking. The meaning's irrelevant. All right, so that's on the one side. That's approaching it from the thought side. How do we approach it from the side of environmental, what he calls environmental phenomena? At the moment I become aware of what he calls environmental phenomena, or the world of form, or the actuality of my experience, it is done, complete. The cloud of probability, all the various ways, all the degrees of freedom, in which reality could have manifested at the time I observe it has no more degrees of freedom, it's done. So what need is there to grasp it with concepts? It's done. See how I can do it from both sides? If it's done, I can put on the gloves of concepts, but it can't be changed. It's just the way it is. This is in my zazen, not in my everyday life, where I have to use concepts and I have to deal with and entangle with what I call a cloud of probability. But in zazen, I sit, all my senses working, and I do nothing. I enter this deep, profound reality. Just. This is just complete, just done. Thoughts arise, no big deal. They're just part of this justness. Thoughts arise because of causes and conditions. The smell of incense arises because of causes and conditions. And at the time it's observed, it is complete, the cloud has collapsed, it's just this. And it's just this moment after moment after moment. Done, 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 as I always put it. From this practice, which we should do every time we sit down, naturally develops what you could call dispassion, which is simply that the gloves of conceptual thinking have been removed, and now the space is there for the world of environmental phenomena to appear unmolested. And then from there we move forward into what Wang Po talked about, seeing the voidness of this environmental phenomenon. Before, I was floating on the surface of it because I was feeling it through the gloves of my conceptual thinking. When I directly, dispassionately allow it, and the conceptual thinking falls away, the energy used to entangle and fight and grasp and hate it and love it is now liberated to simply see that it appears. That's the next step. So without going too far into this, I think we'll end here tonight.